chakkhavalesu atra gacchantu devata santamam munirajasa sunantu sakamokadam dhamma savana kalo ayam badanta dhamma savana kalo ayam badanta dhamma savana kalo ayam badanta namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa Okay, now almost come to the end of the day. Before I start my talk, may I ask you a question first? Okay, this thing. I think this. Okay. Before I start my talk, may I ask you a question first? Do you experience suffering in life? Yes or no? I think no one say no. Okay, no one say no. Because of suffering in life, you come here to practice the Dhamma. Okay, what caused that suffering? What caused your suffering? Testing. Okay, testing. Can you hear? Okay. Testing. Okay. So what caused that suffering? What caused you suffer?
Unsatisfied with life.
Unsatisfaction, huh? Okay. Then, other people? Different people have different answers, right? Unsatisfactory of life. Okay.
Ignorance
causes you suffering. Okay. Some more?
Craving.
Some more? What? Karma. Karma. Okay. Okay. So if you conclude all your answer, craving, unsatisfactory in life, ignorance and so on. So unsatisfactory in life is because of what? Why you feel unsatisfied in life? Because of craving. Yes, desire. Unfulfilled desire. Because of craving or ignorance that causes you suffering in life. Okay, so this ignorance, craving, attachment, unfulfilled desire, where do they come from? Where do they arise? In where? In mind. Right? In mind. So suffering arises from the mind. In order to solve this suffering, to overcome this suffering, you have to directly see the mind. Only then you can overcome it. If you try to avoid it, put it aside or suppress it, it doesn't work. You just can avoid temporarily, but you cannot avoid it permanently. Therefore, if we understand sufferings come from our craving, unfulfilled desire, our ignorance, and our lust, our anger, our hypocrisy, ingratitude, conceit, wrong view, and so on. And all these defilements come from the mind. So in order to overcome all these defilements that cause suffering, we have to direct see these defilements when they arise in your mind. Suppose anger, let's say one defilement. Anger also causes suffering, right? Not only craving. Huh? When anger arises in your mind, if you are not aware of it, or if you react it very fast, almost compulsively, what will happen?
Consuming
yourself. Not only that, if you cannot control, you want to hit other people, right? Because anger is like poison of the snake. It's spread into the body very fast. So you feel very uncomfortable, like fire consume your body, and you also want to react to the externally. So you hurt yourself and you hurt other people. This is the result of not being mindful of your anger. Similarly, when craving arises in your mind, if you are not mindful, what will happen?
You will commit the pacing, that's not craving towards something you need more, so you can commit as an activity like
Yes. So when craving arises in your mind, so if you lust after that craving, then you have to do something to fulfill your desire, right? Because craving is now arising in my mind, and in order to satiate your craving, you have to act. You have to act. Act something. This act means action. This action means karma in Buddha's teaching. So you have to act in order to get that object to satiate your craving. Only then you feel satisfied. So in everyday life, whenever refinements arise in our mind, if we are not mindful, then we always react according to what is arising in the mind, whether it's skillful or unskillful. Sometimes the defilements can be very overwhelming. Although you know it is unskillful, but you cannot control. You just cannot control. Because defilement is so powerful, it overwhelms you. So we react to that defilements, then later on we may feel remorse. Then we say, next time I'm not going to do again. But when you face the challenge again, then you lose to the defilements again. And all this defilement, as you answered me, all this defilement cause us suffering. Therefore, as a practitioner, we must learn two mental factors in order to overcome all the defilements that arise in the mind and to free ourselves from all types of suffering. So first one is mindfulness. Mindfulness, sati. Mindfulness is very popular in USA. Mindfulness is very, very popular in USA nowadays. So what do you understand mindfulness? What do you understand mindfulness? Because it's a very popular term in USA. I think all of you have heard this before. So what's mindfulness? Anyone want to answer?
Deliberate awareness.
To what? Just awareness. So what is awareness? Knowing, aware, just aware, simply aware. No. Okay. Mindfulness is called attentiveness of the mind. Attentiveness, as you say, awareness. But awareness is a bit, I think, a little bit superficial to me. It's close attentiveness of the mind. And this mindfulness and know, simply aware, there's a bit a subtle different. For example, now you are feeling hot. Do you know? Yes or no? When you meditate, now the body becomes really hot. Do you know? No. Is it this mindfulness? Is this mindfulness or not? Why no answer? You all know mindfulness well. Is it this mindfulness? Okay, then I give you two alternatives. You answer me, which one is mindfulness? So you feel hot, you know it's very hot, and you also get affected by the hot. This one. Another one, you feel very hot, you know, aware, but you are not affected by the hot. Which one is mindfulness? Yes, the second one. So sometimes when you're angry, you know you're angry, but you still hit people, you still screaming out, right? I cannot say you are mindful of your anger. If you are mindful of your anger, you do not react. So you must thoroughly understand what's mindfulness. So mindfulness slow down your reaction, so that you will not react to it. You hold on. I give another example. Many years ago, I was in England airport. At a time, the heat wave attacked the England. And inside aeroplane, it was so hot. Everybody, you know, like crazily fencing themselves. I did the same thing. So hot. Then suddenly I feel very shameful to myself. I am a practitioner. Why I behave like them? You know, I'm behaving like them. So what's the difference of my practice compared with them? Right? So I feel very shameful to myself. So I bring up the mindfulness. Call the mindfulness. Mindful of my heat. The heat. The temperature. Mindful of it. Mindfulness is not just know only. Mindfulness sink into the object. As I say this morning, mindfulness not superficially know the object, but mindfulness sinks into the object. For example, you throw a pumpkin into river. Pumpkin just float away. But if you throw a stone into the river, the stone sinks into the bottom. So mindfulness has the characteristic of sinking. Sinking, the mind just sinks into the object. So when I call the mindfulness, try to be mindful of the heat, so I stay with it. I know heat. I know it, heat. At that very moment, I feel myself free from the depression of this heat. And I can see the difference. Before that, I feel very irritated because of the heat. And I'm behaving like other ordinary people. But when I have that precise mindfulness, then I immediately free myself from that suffering. So this is mindfulness. Okay? So it's not simply aware. First you aware, but the mind also sink into it. And you do not react. You do not react because of that situation. So mindfulness has the characteristic of non-superficiality, not superficial, but sinking into the object. And mindfulness has the function of non-forgetfulness. You do not forget. Whatever arises in your mind and body, you do not forget it. You know it, and the mind sinks into it. You do not forget it. And the manifestation of mindfulness is guardianship. Mindfulness guards your mind. For example, when the anger arises in you, if you have the mindfulness, not superficial mindfulness, okay? If you have a precise, sharp mindfulness, then you know anger has arisen in you. You know it, Then it guards your mind from further reaction. You do not react to the anger because of this guardianship, the manifestation of mindfulness. Another way of explanation of this guardianship, for example, while you are walking, if you are mindful of your breath, mindful of one object, we call gochara sampajanya, comprehension of domain. Keep your mind with one single meditation subject. So while you are walking, you keep your mind with one single meditation subject, your mind sink into the object. So if that moment somebody abuse you, scold you, will your mind be affected or not? If yes, then your mindfulness is superficial. So because your mind sinks into the object and somebody scolds you, you may hear the sound, but you may not know the content. Even you know the content, it's not clear. You don't know what he is talking about. So your mind is not shaken. Therefore, mindfulness compare manifestation of mindfulness is guardianship. It guards your mind. Okay. So in order to free our suffering from the oppression of defilements, any types of defilements, either conceit, wandering, ingratitude, greed, craving, and so on, we must apply mindfulness. And please understand correctly the meaning of mindfulness. Not just simply aware. The mind sink into it and do not react. This is the most important. When you react, you perform karma. You perform action. And this action is called karma. And whatever karma once performed, it leaves behind potentiality. We call karmic force. It leaves behind karmic force in one's mentality, one's mental stream. And this karmic force follow the mental stream until it meets with favorable conditions, and this karmic force will pop up and it become the effect. It become the effect. And since that karma is not good karma, then this effect cannot be good effect. It becomes unwholesome effect and we suffer accordingly. So we suffer not only when the defilements arise in the mind. When the defilements arise in the mind, we suffer on the spot. And if we react again, it leaves behind karmic energy, then we suffer later. Later on, we suffer again. And usually, according to the law of karma, effect, one karma does not produce one effect. It's not mathematic. One karma produces one karma can multiply the effect. Therefore, life appears to us full of suffering because karma multiplies. But if we perform enough good karma, then good karma also multiply. So we can enjoy the good result. From here, you can understand how important to have mindfulness when the defilements arise in the mind. However, mindfulness alone is not enough to realize the goal. What is the goal of practice? The cessation of dukkha, not only in this lifetime. So the goal of the practice, as he say, the cessation of dukkha. But before we reach the cessation of dukkha, we must be able to understand the three common characteristics: anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanent, suffering, and non-self. So in order to realize this impermanent, suffering, and non-self, we have to apply another mental factor called wisdom, panya, wisdom. What is wisdom? Wisdom is just a mental factor. All of us have this wisdom inside. However, some people only develop small degree. Some people develop better degree. Some people develop full degree. And wisdom is the key. In the teaching of the Buddha, wisdom is the key point. The most important mental factors in the teaching of the Buddha, not mindfulness. Okay? Because mindfulness is so popular in America, I need to remind you. I need to remind you, mindfulness is not the key point in the teaching of the Buddha. Wisdom is the key point. Mindfulness is just a preliminary for the wisdom to arise. Without mindfulness, wisdom cannot arise. So wisdom always associated with mindfulness also. Mindfulness always associated with wisdom. Okay, so now when defilements arise in our mind, we have mindfulness. We know it already. We know and the mind sink into it. After that, we try to contemplate impermanence. For example, craving. Craving arises in my mind. I know, craving has arisen. Mindfulness, no. Craving has arisen. But I do not react to it. I do not act to get something to satiate my craving. Because I am protected by mindfulness. But I need, in order to deepen my practice, I need to see craving is not permanent. Right? I need to see craving is not a self. I need to see craving is not myself. And I need to see craving cause me suffering. Therefore, in order to see craving is not permanent, craving is not a self, you need to contemplate impermanence. How to contemplate? So when craving arises in you, you know, mindfulness, know it, sink into it, hold the craving, hold it, then mentally you note craving is impermanent. Craving is impermanent. You have to note in this way. Isn't it very simple? Isn't it very simple? It sounds very simple, but we often forget. When craving comes, the craving has very strong power. It immediately seizes your mind, and you are caught. You forget what is mindfulness. You forget what is wisdom already. Therefore, we need to practice constantly, regularly, so that mindfulness and wisdom can stick into the mind, so that we will not forgetful. We will not be forgetful. Okay. So why should we contemplate impermanent? Just now I have mentioned the reason why, but there are few other reasons why we should contemplate impermanent. First, to see the truth. Because to see impermanent is the goal of the practice. So when we contemplate impermanent, 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 gradually we will see the truth. Craving is really impermanent. Then you may ask, just by contemplate mentally, verbally, impermanent, 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 we can really see the impermanent? Some people may question. So when I was in Washington DC 2 years ago, I teach this contemplate impermanence, and one of the students doubt it. She was a Dharma teacher. So one day something happened that she felt a lot of anger. Then she said, "Today my meditation gone. From the very early morning I have so much anger. I think this anger will continue up to the end of the day." But suddenly she felt that, sister asked us to contemplate impermanence. Why not I try? So she tried. Contemplate. Anger is impermanent. Anger is impermanent. Anger is impermanent. Within very short period, she saw anger passed away. She was extremely happy. And she came for my interview and told me that, "Sister, your mantra, contemplate impermanent, is very powerful. When I go back home, I'm going to write down and paste everywhere in my house." So believe it. Contemplate impermanent, impermanent, impermanent. Just mentally say it. So this is the first reason why should we contemplate impermanent, in order to really see its impermanency. If you do not contemplate impermanent, may I ask you, what's your mental state toward your craving? When craving arises, in you, and you don't have this mind, you don't have this contemplation that craving is impermanent. It never strikes your mind at all. At that time, how your mind perceives that craving? How? It's real, it's permanent, right? It is self, it is mind. All these are refinements. All these are not seeing things as they really are. All these are not true. All this way of viewing things give you more suffering, right? If craving arises in your mind and you perceive it, you view it, you perceive it as permanent, you perceive it as real, you perceive it as myself, then how can you free from that craving? Is it true or not? Yes or no? Therefore, you have to contemplate impermanent in order to change your wrong perception of permanent, real, and so on. Even just for this purpose, it's worth contemplate impermanent. Okay. The second reason why you should contemplate impermanent because Buddha say, sabbe sankhara anicca. All formations are impermanent. Whatever arises in your mind and body, all are impermanent. Buddha repeatedly say for 45 years, even up to his last breath, he told the bhikkhu, all formations are subject to change. So for 45 years, Buddha taught the same thing. And if our perception, if our view, the way we view things as permanent, and in reality, all phenomena are impermanent, but we view as permanent, then these two never come into agreement, right? They go opposite. Then how can you experience, how can the truth unfold in your inside knowledge? How can the truth of impermanence unfold itself? Because your view and the truth is completely opposite. It makes sense or not? It makes sense, right? Therefore, in order to realize impermanence, you have to contemplate impermanence so that your perception harmonizes with the truth. So that your mentality tune in with reality. Only then the reality can unfold itself. When you realize our defilements are impermanent, even once. If you realize even once, then you have more confidence in the teaching of the Buddha. Yes, it is impermanent. It is impermanent. So next time any other defilements comes, then you will not be carried away by the defilements, or you will not scared by that defilements, because you know soon it will pass away. And your mind become courageous. You have inner strength. Okay, so this is the second reason why we should contemplate impermanent. The third reason, when we contemplate impermanent, we sever the craving. Suppose your eye come to contact with an agreeable object. When the eye come to contact with very pleasant, agreeable, desirable object, owing to the eye contact, then pleasant feeling arises. And depend on the pleasant feelings, craving arises. So at that time, if we do not contemplate impermanent, the craving will become stronger. And as I say, then the action will follow that craving. The karma will follow that craving. Therefore, in order to sever the craving, then we have to contemplate impermanent. When we contemplate impermanent, then subconsciously we stop the craving. Even though we cannot stop it completely, we may stop it maybe 20%, 30%, and so on. So if you do not stop that craving, Buddha said repeatedly, craving is the origin of all suffering. So craving is the main enemy that we have to handle it skillfully. So by contemplating impermanent, we gradually sever the craving little by little. When craving is severed little by little, then the suffering also will lessen. Okay, the fourth purpose to contemplate impermanence is to teach our subconsciousness to let go. When you mentally say impermanent, impermanent, then subconsciously you know, since it is impermanent, why should I grasp it? Why should I hold on to it? Then I let it go. I let go of it. So subconsciously, if you contemplate impermanent, it also teaches your consciousness to let go, let go, let go. So based on this four purposes, we have to contemplate impermanent in order to free ourselves from suffering, in order to realize the truth. So when you see enough suffering, when you see enough impermanence, whatever arises in you, you see, you contemplate impermanent, and gradually you see it really passes away again and again, again and again. Then gradually you will develop disenchantment, disenchantment, dispassion towards whatever arises in the mental state. This disenchantment is very, very important insight in one's practice, culminating insight in one's practice. Without feeling disenchanted, like without feeling dissatisfaction in life, we will hang on to life. We think life gives us abundant happiness. Life gives us satisfaction, happiness, and so on. But if you have experienced this disenchantment in life, then you start to see world in different way. I give you an example. Suppose a child, when he first see the firework, very beautiful firework, he was enchanted. He liked it very much. So beautiful, the firework. So one day, because of his attachment, craving attachment to this firework, so one day, out of curiosity, he grabs that firework. And he got burned. Once he got burned, then he started to realize this is not something enjoyable. It's not something enjoyable. It is dangerous. It hurts. And through his own experience, then he started to keep away from that firework because it's dangerous. It hurts. Therefore, so long we do not experience this disenchantment, then we will still cling to our senses, we will still cling to our mind and body without having desire to abandon that attachment. So after seeing enough impermanent, we experience this disenchantment. Okay, and this is very important inside knowledge. Some people while contemplating impermanent, 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 they also experience suffering. Because when things arise, passes away, arise, passes away, arises and passes away, arises and passes away consistently, then you will feel that it's not something enjoyable. It's something that you feel that is very oppressive. Being oppressed by constant arising and passing away. And at that time, you understand what Buddha said. Sabbe sankhara dukkha. All formations are suffering. So in order to see suffering, you have to experience impermanence. And for sometimes, instead of contemplate impermanent, we can contemplate non-self as well. We can contemplate non-self. For example, when somebody praise you, somebody praise you, and that praise word, praise sound come to contact with the ear, because of ear contact, and because the words is pleasant, and owing to the pleasant word and due to ear contact, then pleasant feeling arises. Pleasant feeling arises in you. If you are not aware of the pleasant feeling, then craving for that praise arise. Craving for the gain, for the praise arise again and again. And we get caught without realizing it. But if we have mindfulness, when we experience an unpleasant feeling, we know it, hold it, the mind sink into that feeling, then we can also contemplate this feeling is not a permanent self. This feeling is not a permanent self. This feeling is not a permanent self. If feeling is not a self, what is feeling? What is feeling? Do you have feeling? Yes. What is feeling? Why? Okay, if I ask what is feeling, it's very difficult to answer. Feeling is feeling. Why feeling arises? Why feeling arises? Why? Because of contact. So when feeling, whether pleasant or unpleasant feeling arises in you, you have to ask yourself, what is this feeling? Then you know, feeling is just feeling. And why or where, from where feeling arises? Oh, then you know, because of contact, because of that pleasant sound that strike my ear, that trigger the pleasant feeling. So pleasant feeling is just an effect. It's just an effect of ear contact. It's just an effect of ear contact. And ear contact is impermanent. Right? Pleasant sound is impermanent. So if you can contemplate in this way, then you free yourself. Owing to, dependent on pleasant feeling, craving arises again. But if you can contemplate wisely in this way, you free yourself from craving again. And if the word is unpleasant, abusive word, strike your ear, then unpleasant feeling arises. And depend on that unpleasant feeling, anger arises. Anger, very angry with that abusive word. Instead of contemplating unpleasant feeling, anger as non-self, then we directly aim to that person who uttered the abusive word, right? We always automatically, instead of see inwardly, then we start to aim at that person who uttered abusive word, and we make enemy with him. This is what happened every day, right? I remember once when I was in Pa'au, Myanmar Meditation Center. At that time, many monks, thousands of monks coming for Pintabhata. And at that time, I was talking with Pao Siado, my teacher. I was talking with Pao Siado. And because of my talking with Pao Siado, the Pintabhata was a little bit delayed. So the kapya, the attendant who's in charge of that Pintabhata, get very angry with me. So in public, hundreds of monks and people, he shouted at me very loud. So at that moment, I feel very shameful because of ego. Ego was hurt. So that when ego was hurt, I feel very shameful. I feel very shameful for, I think, about one or 2 minutes. Then suddenly I remember the teaching of Sariputta. The teaching of Sariputta in, I think, in Majjhima Nikaya, I think 22. Then I remember Venerable Sariputta say, unpleasant feeling arises. Why? Due to unpleasant ear contact. Because that attendant scolded me in the public. So I feel very unpleasant. And this unpleasant feeling arises because of ear contact. Then Venerable Sariputta say, ear contact is impermanent. Sound, abusive word is impermanent. So I contemplate according to his instruction. So I contemplate ear contact is impermanent, sound is impermanent, then unpleasant feeling is impermanent, is non-self. So after this way of contemplation, I feel all my anger, all the hurt disappear. So I free myself from anger. I free myself from suffering. So this way of contemplation is very, very helpful. And also it deepened your insight knowledge. So if we can contemplate in this way, again and again, then gradually we will not gradually we will be free from many forms of craving, many forms of anger. And if we can contemplate it as non-self, what I have mentioned just now, when unpleasant feeling arises in you, then you investigate what causes the arising of unpleasant feeling, owing to one of the contexts. We have six contact. Eye contact also can cause anger, right? When you see your enemy, immediately anger arises. And when you hear the abusive word, immediately anger arises. Or when you eat something delicious, immediately greed arises. And when you smell something bad, immediately you don't like it. Anger arises. And when your body touch the hard cushion, immediately you don't like it. You don't like is a type of anger, right? Subtle anger. And when you think of something bad, immediately anger arises. When you think of something good, immediately greed arises. So all the time, we are surrounded by anger, greed, conceit, ego, and so on, again and again, if we do not have mindfulness and wisdom. This is how we suffer. This is how we suffer from our craving, our anger, our refinements. This is how we experience unsatisfactory in life. So therefore, when anger arises, investigate. Investigate is a type of wisdom. We call Dhamma Vichaya. Seven factors of enlightenment. The second factor is investigation. So investigate why anger arises in you, why unpleasant feeling arises in you. After investigation, you will find there are certain causes. Then you tackle that causes. Tackle that causes, then this effect will disappear. Then you can free from suffering. Or another way, you can contemplate non-self, and ask yourself, if it's non-self, what is this? What is this anger? What is this unpleasant feeling? So upon investigation, you know it's just an effect. It's just an effect of certain causes. And when you can see causes and effect, when you can see causal relationship or cause and effect, then the inside knowledge of non-self also will become manifest. Also will become clear. So to understand non-self, you must understand cause and effect. Without understanding cause and effect, it's very difficult to understand non-self. Okay, so far, are you with me? Any question before I continue again? Or it's too much for you? It's too much for you to follow, then we can stop here and open for discussion. Okay.
I'm curious, after you more or less catch yourself from anger, say in a situation where someone might scold you, the next step should come from wisdom, but I'm curious how that looks. Do you just go around blank? I doubt that. You got to have a way to react in a positive, skillful way, but there still should be something there.
Just like my story just now, I just contemplate it. As long as my mindfulness and wisdom are quick and sharp, I just contemplate it, contemplate my unpleasant feeling first. Because I was scolded in the public, right? So it's very unpleasant. I feel very unpleasant. So I contemplate it, unpleasant feeling, it's impermanent, it's not a self. Then owing to what, it arises. Then I contemplate because of ear contact. And ear contact also depend on the abusive word. If it's pleasant word, I don't feel unpleasant, right? Because of abusive word, then I feel unpleasant. So upon investigation, then the cause and effect relationship become clear. Then I contemplate it as a non-self, as impermanent, then it just go away. Okay? Yes? Yes. Sing and suppress is different, huh? What I mean, sing, I mean you know it, you know it, but you do not identify with it. Neither you suppress it. Maybe in this case, for unwholesome, sink may not be a good word. You thought sink is not indulge in the anger. So your mind just hold it as an object of observation. You regard the anger as the object of observation. So when you hold it and regard and take it as an object of observation, you give the room for wisdom to arise, to know anger is impermanent. You give room for wisdom to arise, to know anger is not a self, not a permanent self. There are two ways to deal with this anger. Non-practitioner, they want to push it away. Better go away fast, as fast as possible. Go away, I don't want it. But we are practitioner. We come here to meditate, right? We are practitioner. So just by pushing it away, it doesn't solve. It doesn't cure the root. Right? We want to solve it permanently. So we like sink into it, like we hold it and take it as an object of observation. When you take it as an object of your observation, at that moment, you do not identify anger as myself. You just separate it. Separate yourself with the anger and take it as an object of observation and watch it. Allow the wisdom to understand it is impermanent. Allow the wisdom to understand it is non-self. You are not keeping it in the bottom of the heart, no. You are not suppressing it. Yes, of course. That also helps. You can take a deep breath and hold it. You can take a deep breath. That it also helps. But without taking the deep breath, if you can handle it mentally, that even better, right? Yes. Okay. Any other question? Yes. Sorry.
Enlightened one nowadays, because when you read history during the Buddha time, seem like a lot of monks enlightened. So many the arahants. I wonder today, at present day, 2015, anything that consider the one who practice so hard become enlightened? Any way that you can tell?
yesterday, I think yesterday, Friday night, And I give a talk in the Vietnamese temple. Arahant's mind is untraceable. Untraceable, cannot be traced. So for ordinary person, we cannot know. Only Arahant can know who is Arahant. Arahant mind is untraceable by ordinary person. But I believe they are Arahant. If not Arahant, I think the teaching of Buddha will soon disappear. So I think they are Arahants. Yes. Because of impermanent, you want to enjoy more.
Yes. Because you know, I know it's going to go away, and really, and you know. So what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong. That enjoying under the sun is not a hindrance for the spiritual path. You know, it's not a hindrance. You can enjoy it, but don't so attached to it. No, no, you should. If you think that enjoy under the sun is also an unwholesome thing, I think there's no purpose living in this life already. To me, okay, go and enjoy the sun. It's good for your health. You think it's good for your health. Just like we exercise, good. Good for the health only. Yes. We used to spend time to exercise our body for the health, but we spend very little time to exercise the mind. Right? Okay.
So back to your same example, from not doing it.
Yes.
And then maybe a week later I remember, and then it arrives as if a lot of stuff, but it's really the memory gone.
Yes. That's why it's.
Go through that over and over again.
Yes. That's why it's suffering, struggling. It's very suffering. You thought it ceases already. Very soon it comes up again. it comes again. Then you contemplate again. Then it ceases. Oh, what a bliss. Soon it comes again. That's why you have to keep on contemplating until you become Arahant. Keep on contemplating. I remember one of my experience in Sri Lanka. At that time, I had very unpleasant feeling, full of suffering in life. Because of a certain issue. Then I don't know how to handle this suffering already. Finally, I say to myself, the only way to handle with this suffering is to face it. So I start to contemplate. Unpleasant feeling. Previously, I tried to escape, suppress it. Try to put aside. But it doesn't help. It doesn't work. So finally, I face it. Face it. So I contemplate unpleasant feeling. And very soon, I see this unpleasant feeling arises, passes away very fast. And every time it arises, my mind feels the suffering. And every time when it ceases, I feel the bliss. But it does not end there. It arises again, I feel suffering. And it ceases again, I feel the bliss. It arises again, I feel suffering. It ceases again, I feel the bliss. And finally, it ceases completely. And that, from that experience, I understand what Vibhana is. If it ceases, never arise again, this is Vibhana. This is completely bliss.
Your mind can be so tricky. Like, you could have said to yourself, okay, I'm letting go of this, but I hope the monk says something for that attendant. You know, your mind is so...
Then you have to aware of your mind. Your mindfulness must be fast enough to aware what's happening in the mind, and don't be cheated by all this thought. Don't be cheated by all this thought. These thoughts are created by yourself, by oneself. We create our thoughts, and if we indulge in our thought, we make our thought real. And when we make it real, we react to it, and we suffer even more. Every morning, in Malaysia, every morning I went for a walk. If I'm not mindful, if I do not keep one object with me, for example, mindfulness of breathing or metta or whatever object, if I do not keep any object with me, I can see my mind wander here and there, you know. And when my mind wander here and there, I also feel a lot of suffering. Just because of this wandering thought, give me a lot of suffering. So in order to free myself from suffering, pull my mind back, focus on my breath, then suffering ceases. That's all. So if you keep on indulge in this wandering thought, really you make it real. You see, so many people have this, mental sickness. They have mental sickness. Sometimes we don't understand their behavior, right? Because they react to the thoughts. They create their own thoughts, and they keep on arguing, talking to their thoughts. That's how the mental sickness comes. Therefore, because I always contemplate my thoughts, I know many times my thoughts cheat me. If I'm not mindful, then I think what I think is real. Then I react a little bit, then finally I know, I'm cheated again. Stop. Okay?
Can you tell more in general about how to contemplate anatta?
Okay, you want to contemplate anatta, first you must analyze cause and effect. Just I say, whatever sensation that arise in your body and mind, all based on the contact. Six contact: eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, and mind contact. So whatever arise in your mind and body are based on this contact, six contacts. So you must analyze it. Okay, now unpleasant feeling arise. Based on what it arises? On what? You analyze yourself. It can be eye contact, it can be ear contact, and so on. Or it can be your own unwise attention to that object. So if you analyze in this way, then you understand, just cause and effect relationship. Cause and effect relationship. Then gradually the non-self nature of phenomena will become clear to you. This is one of the way to analyze it. And another way is when you see impermanent, when you see suffering, also non-self will become clear. When you see things keep on arising, passing away, then you feel that you have no control over them. Right? Things comes and go, you have no control over them, and that is also a sign of non-self. Okay. Yes. Say it again. What is the advantage of observing? Out of meditation. What is the advantage of observing the object? Okay, I think I mentioned just now, when your mind is not guarded, when your mind is not guarded by mindfulness on one single object, the nature of the mind is just wander here and there. The nature of the mind is wander here and there because your mind is not guarded with one single object. Then you let loose the mind. Then the mind goes here and there, and it causes a lot of stress in the mind. And if we are not mindful enough, you know, when you're thinking something, when you think of something, and if you keep on thinking on that thing, you make the thought real because of your indulgement in it. And you make the thought real, then you start to react to that thought. This is the disadvantage. So the advantage to keep the mind on a single object, after out of meditation, is to protect your mind from going wild. To protect from mind, to protect your mind from wandering here and there endlessly. That endlessly wandering here and there endlessly is also very tiring for the mind. You don't feel the peace, you don't feel the bliss. You know, it's a type of suffering also. To me. Okay. But some people may enjoy. Enjoy thinking here and there. Enjoy fantasy. You know? Because they don't see the suffering yet. To me it's very strong suffering if I let loose my mind. Any other question? No more? Okay, so since there's no question, we should end here, right? Unless you have question. Okay. Oh no! When you ask question, then I can say something, something new. Okay.
And then you said that later we'll be applying.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you did this or not, but if we did not do this, how do you, or what would be going into mindfulness? Let's say you tried, you know, concentration, you think you established a system in your concentration. How do you go into mindfulness? What's your next step?
This morning I incorporate mindfulness and concentration. If a person just practice, let's say, just practice pure concentration, then mindfulness of the breath. So whatever arises in the mind, in the body, we just ignore. Don't care. No need to note impermanent suffering. No, not necessary. This is called pure concentration practice. But if like this morning I say we incorporate mindfulness and concentration, so while we are breathing in and out, a wandering thought arises. Then we watch it, observe it, and see it passes away and come back to the breath. And breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, a sensation arises. Then we shift our attention to that sensation and see. Maybe see four elements, see it passes away, see how it affects the mind, and if it irritates the mind, then contemplate the mind, you know. So we incorporate mindfulness and concentration practice. Yes?
You were talking about walking and your personal story, and being distracted by things, like having but there are certain activities that are just too complex to have a primary object, like ballet dancer or something. You know, they can't be thinking, you know, of breath or something. I mean, they got to be one with that activity. It's got to be. And the other thing is, you know, you're talking about having separation, secreting, so separation. But, you know, when you're doing a complex activity, there's got to be like oneness with the activity. You know, that separation. If you're thinking, okay, I gotta, can you say more about that?
a complex activity, it's very difficult to keep the mind in a single object, because there's involvement, engagement inside, right? Just like when I write my book, Dhamma book, I cannot separate myself from if not, I don't know how to write the book. So certain occasion, there's involvement. No, you feel that it's a self involvement in it, in order to make it efficient, then there's a self involvement there. But when we come to practice, we have to bear in mind we don't get involved in things. We want to see the non-self nature, so we separate, try to detach ourselves from the mental state, detach ourselves from any sensation that arises in the body. We just observe it far away. Not identify it with the object. This is during the practice, but in the daily life, if you have multitask, I think it's very difficult. It's a bit difficult. Is the question you ask, is this?
Is it possible to know when you're not being mindful at a complex activity? Is it just you start to notice confused feeling or emotional state?
When we have multi activities, I think it's very difficult to be mindful. Very difficult. Therefore, Buddha said, have few duties. Buddha said, have few duties. If not, you get caught in all these things. I also feel if I have multitask, my mindfulness become very blunt. I'm not sharp anymore.
Right.
That's why I say only when you are in the practice. But if you are driving car, reading a book, you have to be worldly. You have to be worldly. You cannot be, you know. Because we monk and nun, we have very few duties compared with the worthy person. So to keep the mindfulness with us still possible, but still not all the time. Only Arahan has 100% mindfulness. Anagami 75%. Sagadagami 50%. Sotapan 25%. Ordinary person, 1 or 2, 3, 5% maybe. So you know it's not possible to have 100% mindfulness all the time. Even the anagami cannot have that. So be practical. Be more practical. Okay, yes.
Well, I use the example of sitting here and really putting my full attention and listening to the
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's mindfulness. And if I notice I go somewhere else and I pull myself back, or if I have to study something, or if I have to chat here,
yes, that's also. This also one type of mindfulness. But if you read the four foundation of mindfulness, this is under clear comprehension. When you're walking, you're turning around, and when you're stretching, you know. This is under the section of clear comprehension. Not only know you're cutting. That knowing is not enough. Commentaries give an example. It's very controversial point. Commentaries give an example. When a dog is walking, do you think the dog know he is walking? You better ask the dog behind. Okay, what do you think? Do you think the dog know he is walking?
No.
Even you call the dog come, the dog come or not? So how can he not know he's walking? Right? You ask the dog come, you ask the dog to do some action, he can follow. So he has the consciousness. So the dog, when the dog walks, he knows he's walking. So if you are chopping, you know you are chopping. What's the difference with the dog know he's walking?
Now
I don't say that you do not know. Now I say you know you are chopping. Okay? And the no dog is walking. Okay? What's the difference?
I can bring more consciousness.
If you say that this is mindfulness, then the dog also has mindfulness. Right? Right? Therefore, commentary disagree. Mindfulness is not so simple like this. Now I'm chopping, now I'm walking. No. Not so simple. So, clear comprehension, for example, chop, not only chopping. Then you contemplate your intention to chop. Because of that intention, the body follows. So it's only mind and matter. This is called mindfulness and clear comprehension. Not only chopping. Not enough. But this is what practice nowadays, right? This is what practice nowadays. I practice this type of mindfulness, a way of everything I do, stretching my hand, flexing my mindfulness and slow motion for 6 years. Like you said, chopping. At a time, I think I miss one important ingredient in my practice. So I only practice mindfulness. Now what I'm doing, chopping, walking, stretching, chewing, you know, seeing, hearing, mindfulness. After 6 years, I feel very dissatisfied. I'm not satisfied with my practice, although I strive very hard. And finally, after many years, only I realize one ingredient is missing. Just like when you cook something, you forget to put salt. Just like it doesn't taste good. And that ingredient is wisdom. Precisely wisdom. Lacking wisdom. So after 6 years practice, I don't feel I'm progressing. My perception of impermanence is not strong, and my deformations are as great as before after 6 years intensive practice. I have to live. Only after many years, I start to realize the missing part of my practice is wisdom. Because I do not contemplate impermanence, because I do not investigate, because I do not contemplate non-self. Therefore, all this impermanent, anicca, dukkha, anatta, all this knowledge do not come to me. Therefore, if you practice mindfulness, chopping, not enough. Wisdom cannot unfold itself. Okay? Okay, so what do you think at that time? What is the mindfulness when she is chopping?
Well, like you were describing the Mahasi method, I'm assuming you're talking about when you were practicing the Mahasi method.
I don't want to say any tradition. We are not criticizing any tradition, okay? Not only chopping.
Reaching, you know, that just insight.
Yes, yes.
That's not wisdom.
Right, right.
But did you ever bring that up to your teacher and say, I mean, can't I go beyond that now and drop the labeling? I mean, you can drop the label.
I dropped the label later on. Later on, I think maybe at that time I'm still very young, 20 something. I'm still very young, and I do not have found. I do not have found knowledge of Sutta and Abhidhamma. Therefore, I cannot. I do not know what's missing in my practice. And of course, the teachers do not emphasize that much, because that practice emphasizes only mindfulness. Maybe he will wait until the wisdom of mindfulness. When you have enough mindfulness, sometimes wisdom will come also. But at that time, I think the missing part is very clear, and plus, the teacher did not emphasize the contemplation of impermanence, suffering, investigation. And plus, I don't have enough sutta knowledge and abhidhamma knowledge. And because of that, I do not make progress. So, and at that time, I do not voice out to my teacher, because I don't know what's missing at that time. I told you already, only after many years I realized what's missing. And now I teach, when I teach, I emphasize a lot this wisdom, because I learn from my mistake. Right? I learn from my mistake. So I keep on telling my student, mindfulness alone is not enough. Wisdom is the most important, essential part in the teaching of the Buddha. And if you can study four foundations of mindfulness, many people, they study four foundations of mindfulness in the first part only. They neglect the second part. First part, Buddha say, you're mindful. When there's anger, you know there's anger. When there's greed, you know there's greed. So many people emphasize this part. But the second part, Buddha also say, you see the factor, the arising factors of anger, and you see the cessation factors of the anger, and you see the arising and cessation factors of anger. What's arising and cessation? Impermanence. And this part is largely ignored by many people. Therefore, people only emphasize mindfulness, and forget the important ingredient, which is wisdom. Okay, this. I think it's in my notes. Yes, in my notes, yes. Yes. Okay.
Since you talk about the wisdom, which is the ultimate teaching,
yes.
Concentration or meditation will help, and you also mentioned studying the sutra for developing the wisdom.
Yes.
Other than that, there are any other suggestions?
Other suggestions to improve the wisdom? Practice is the only way you can really realize the wisdom. But here I would like to give you I would like to recommend you to study Sutta and Abhidhamma. Sutta, discourse of the Buddha, and Abhidhamma. As I mentioned just now, when I was young, I follow the teacher's instruction, 100%. I practice very hard. But at the time, I don't have sutta knowledge. I don't have abhidhamma knowledge. If I have, as I have now, I will add this missing ingredient myself. but because at that time I don't have. That's why I don't know what is wrong in that practice. I don't mean that the practice is wrong. Some people may realize Nibbana if they practice that way, but not for me. Okay? Please don't misrepresent me. Huh? I do not say that way of practice is wrong. But to me, it's not enough. But maybe to somebody it's enough. So, for your benefit, I will encourage you to study Sutta and study Abhidhamma. When you have this knowledge, you will know who is correct teacher, who teaches correctly. Without this knowledge, you are unable to discriminate. This is for your own benefit. Because there are many teachers coming to USA to teach so many traditions, right? Sometimes you don't know. This teacher say like that, that teacher say like that, you get lost. So in order for you to be able to recognize who teach correctly according to the original teaching of the Buddha, why not you study yourself? You study yourself, at least when next time when some teacher say something, at least you have some discriminate knowledge to know what he say is correct or not. Okay? Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And
giving the suggestion it worked.
Yes, yes.
Having seen and had spoken to many teachers and many different approaches to anapana, how would you discriminate? How would you know the abdomen versus the nose versus just the nostrils?
Buddha mentioned in the text. Because I come from Theravada tradition and come from Burma tradition, so I think to us what we say must be based on the text, which is very important. If I say something without based on the text, my own opinion, my own view, my point, my view, my opinion may not be correct, right? So we must say something based on the text. So in Anapana Sutta, Buddha say, Satting Parimukhang, Pali words. Satting means sati, mindfulness. Parimukhang means in front of your face. So Buddha say, when you practice mindfulness, put the mindfulness in front of your face. Based on this one. Okay? So we don't follow the breath. And also through many interviews with so many people, we come to conclusion. If you don't follow the breath, your concentration goes deeper. Okay, there's one more. Just, okay. Say it again, one more time.
I mean, like some people, they recite the name.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Whether that, and then reciting Buddha's name for sure is mindfulness, but with that.
Without wisdom, huh?
Yeah.
This only concentration. You recite Buddha's name, it's just concentration practice. Not wisdom part.
But you know, I know some of us practice and recite for a long time. It's that we practice and every time we see our anger, sort of like we change our subject for Buddha's name. Try to use the Buddha's
replace
the anger with the Buddha's name.
Yeah, yes.
And then eventually, all our thought or everything. So in this way, and this is how we practice.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and then we bow to immerse in the Buddha's pure language.
Mm-hmm.
So but like you suggest when we just keep practice mindfulness and properly this way running to the we miss the wisdom part. So when we recite
understand. So you want my comment?
Yes.
My comment will be very hurtful, no? So first you must understand what is the meaning of wisdom. Wisdom is to penetrate into ultimate truth, penetrate into four noble truths. Wisdom sees anicca, dukkha, anatta. So if you recite Buddha's name and at the same time you can realize anicca, dukkha, anatta, then it's fine. But if you recite Buddha's name without realization of anicca, dukkha, anatta, it's very wholesome deed. You know, kusala, sanye, it's very wholesome deed. And when anger comes, you recite Buddha's name. So you put aside the anger. But you do not see the impermanence of anger. You do not see the non-self of anger. You just put it aside. You replace it with good, wholesome name, good name only. You just replace it only. This very different from you directly see the impermanence and non-self of the anger. That is wisdom. So you just replace it and put aside it and use Buddha's name. That can give you very, we call higher citta, adicitta, higher consciousness. Because concentration, I assume this way of practice is concentration practice. It gives you a brilliant light, it gives you a lot of faith to the Buddha. But I think the wisdom part, I still feel is missing. Because in the 40 subject of meditation, concentration subject, teach in Visuddhimagga, there is also one called contemplate or recollecting the virtues of the Buddha. Just call Buddha's name, Buddha Sammasambuddho, then reflect his virtues. But this is under concentration practice, not wisdom practice. We also have, Theravada also have. Theravada also has this tradition, recite Buddha's name and reflect his virtues, but it's under concentration practice, it's not under wisdom practice.
So what we miss is the wisdom part.
Yes,
but
yes.
Like you said,
you recite,
and at the same time, contemplate the impermanence and the
happiness. Yes. Then, okay. Yeah. If you can add in, this missing part, I think you may progress even further. You can progress further. Even Buddha is impermanent, right? Buddha also past non-self. Buddha is also impermanent, non-self, and then you contemplate also. You add in this contemplation of impermanence, suffering, non-self. Okay. Yes? To read. All the sutta, okay. Sangyutta Nikaya. Sangyutta Nikaya Sutta is directly connected with insight knowledge meditation. Sangyutta Nikaya, Sangyingpu. Sangyutta, Sangyutta Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya. Sangyutta Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya. but it's quite thick. But Zha Hanjing is not correct translation of it's Mahayana way. It still belong to Mahayana Sutta. You read the English version by Bhikkhu Bodhi, Sangyutta Nikaya and Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourse, and another one is what connected. Another one is connected discourse. Okay. No. Sangyutta Nikaya all about impermanent suffering, non-self, and a lot of it can deepen your inside knowledge. Sangyutta Nikaya. Okay, that's all. So we end here. Let's transfer merit. Etavata chammehi sampadang punya sampadang sappe deva anumodantu sappa sampati siddhiya etavata chammehi sampadang punya sampadang sappe bhuta anumodantu sappa sampati siddhiya etavata chammehi sampadang punya sampadang sappe satta anumodantu sappa sampati siddhiya akatasa cha bhummata devanaga mahidika punyatam anumoditva chiram rakkhantu sasanam chiram rakkhantu desanam chiram rakkhantu mangparam. Follow me. Idam me punyam nidhanasa pachayo hotu. Idam me punyam sabhasatanam dema sadhu. Sadhu, sadhu, anumodantu. Okay, sorry, I want to explain a little bit more about your question, like chopping one. Okay, so if a yogi, if a practitioner, he chop like that, if she can see the impermanent of every action, impermanent arising and passing away by chopping, then it's okay.
You know the Mahasi side of it. A lot of the American teachers, that's what they're teaching basically. And I tried that for a long time, and the labeling, really got in my way. And I really looked into the writings of Mahasi side of it, and also that aren't, the obvious teachings. And I find that, and also Chinmay Sayadaw. I can show you places in his writings where he said he distinguishes between noting and labeling. It's kind of a language thing, I think, but, the bare noting, it isn't necessarily accompanied by the labeling. The labeling is like a beginning thing that you do, if it's helpful. But when the noting of every precise thing is not conceptual, saying to yourself, chopping.
Then why should you mean not noting mentally, or just without any sound in the mind?
Kind of like
it's not observing or noting. You mean not mentally or?
There's a conscious recognition, but it's not what you have to say. Chopping.
So how you note? Okay, how you note? You have been practicing for a long time, huh?
Well, actually, I don't want to pretend that I represent that method.
Okay, okay.
I learned from it, and I suppose aspects of it, but I can't say that I represent that method. It's just that Mm. There was a lot of wisdom in that teaching, and I always wanted to understand it more than what appeared on the surface, which was, you know, chopping.
Yes.
I find that if you look deeply enough, there's a place where they say, well, that's kind of beginning practice, you know, to label
okay.
conceptual words, you know, the noting is much more subtle. And in fact, when you're talking about, you know, the deeper levels of insight where, you know, the mind wants,
yes.
how could you possibly label?
Okay. If you have time, I just want to share a little bit. Huh? Okay. The Sui U Min method now in Burma, Sui U Min Sia Do is together with Sia Do Upanita. This are very personal, but you will never heard before. Sui Min Sia Do with Sia Do Upanita, both of them are the Mahasi teacher in the Mahasi center. After 10 years, Sui Min Sia Do left Mahasi center, while Sia Do Upanita remained there. Okay, so Sui Min Sia Do left the center and started his own monastery. And he started another one method. This method say two things you should not do. One is labeling. Precisely against Mahasi's labeling. The second, don't move so slow. You know, if you go to forest refuge, they move very slow. I have been moving so slow for 6 years, enough for me. You know, my teacher asked me, you must move slow like patient. Okay, I am very obedient. So 6 years, I hold my body almost collapsed already because no exercise. How can you move slow for so many years, right? So later on, I left because no satisfaction. I left this tradition. I don't mean that this tradition is not good, but I only want to say not suitable for me. Okay? So later on, after many years, I went to Sui U Min, a monastery, and the teacher instruct precisely this too. Don't do. No labeling at all. Then don't move so slow, move naturally. At that time, I left Mahasi for a long time already, and I already discovered one of the weaknesses of labeling. Because labeling is slow down your observation, it hinder your observation. Because of labeling, it's only words. It blocks you to see things as they really are. So even noting is not okay. Drop labeling. Drop nothing, just observe silently. All this word now, because all formation arise and pass away very fast. 1 second, you go and labor. No, not okay. Too slow. It become a hindrance for the insight. Later on, I realized myself. And when I went to Su Min, the teacher said like that, I was so happy. And when I went to San Francisco, I just point out, because some of them also practicing Mahasi method. So at the time, I just want to share, right? I just want to, with good intention, I want to share. I say, don't labor. Huh? Don't labor. Labor is too slow for your insight to come out. Because labeling is only words. Huh? It's too slow. And one of the audience, who is maybe is a great supporter for Mahasi tradition, after that step out and keep on arguing with me, you know, how can you criticize Mahasi Sia Do? He's a great great meditation teacher. How can you criticize him? I say, I'm not criticizing. I just give my point of view. I say labeling is very slow, you know. But he keep on following me wherever I go, just following me, want to quarrel with me only. Then later on, I give up. I don't want to say already. This labeling or not labeling, I don't want to say, because some people, they practice in this way. If I say labeling is not good, it hurts. Okay, just want to share with you. So if chopping, you don't say, no need to say chopping. No need, you just observe your hand gesture, then see the impermanent. Then it's okay. If not, then you remember, the dog also know he is walking. I also know I'm chopping. What is the difference? You must ask yourself, what is the difference? And the commentary say that the difference is a practitioner will remove the perception of self. The dog does not remove the perception of self. So while chopping, you only see mind and matter, because the intention want to chop and my action follow, then it's only mind and matter relationship, then you remove the perception of self. And this makes the difference. You are chopping and the dog is walking. When the dog is walking, the dog does not remove the perception of self. This is what commentary say. Okay? So, just chopping, knowing chopping not enough. Okay, that's all. Thank you.